Hi, it's Nicholas. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. I just wanted to leave a quick note before this episode. It's a great episode. We had a really interesting discussion about globalization and whether the coronavirus would change our perception of it. And as part of this conversation, we talked to our colleague, Alicia Garcia Herrero, down the line from Spain. She normally lives in Hong Kong, but she's in Spain at the moment. Unfortunately, the Skype line isn't perfect. There are a few little interruptions, but the conversation's really good. I strongly advise you stick with it. So I'm sorry for the quality of the audio, but I think you're really going to enjoy this discussion. So without further ado, here's The Sound of Economics. Hello, I'm still Nicholas Barrett, and you're listening to The Sound of Economics. And depending on where you are in the world, you may be listening with headphones on your ears and a mask over your mouth. As the coronavirus continues to spread, schools have closed, flights have been cancelled, and entire cities have been quarantined. Most of those who contract the virus will undoubtedly survive, but can the same be said for globalisation? Is it time for economists to question the virtue of international supply chains? Should policymakers in the West be thinking twice about our material dependency on Chinese manufacturing? And is an economic contagion as dangerous as its medical alternative? To discuss this, I'm joined by Nicholas Ferron and Nicholas Potier, and down the line from Spain by Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hey.
So, because there are three Nicholases today, I think I'll be referring to you by our full names, just to clarify. So, Nicholas Ferron, how serious is this?
Difficult to say because it's still early days. The virus was confined to China to a large extent until extremely recently. Now it's clear that it's gone across Chinese borders and in many countries and continents. Also, the virus, we know a bit more about this virus now, but we don't know how it may mutate. Therefore, there's a whole range of scenarios depending on how this virus behaves or misbehaves. Now, I'm not going to pretend I have any knowledge whatsoever in epidemiology and health life sciences issues, but clearly this uncertainty, which is about the science and the life science, is affecting economic outcomes.
Nicholas Poitier, it's been the worst week for global equity since the financial crisis in 2008. Is this mindless panic or is it warranted?
I mean, there are downside risks. I'm a bit of the on the more optimistic side. So I'm not an epidemiologist. So I as Nicholas said, I also cannot really speak about this about the medical side of this. So my assessment would be the same. I think financially there is a downside risk. So we don't know how long this will be there, and there are a lot of companies that are directly affected. I think from a global growth perspective, I'm more positive. I think this is gonna be a difficult first quarter. It's gonna be difficult, maybe a difficult second quarter. But I think once we know more and once we see more that it's contained, I think the economy will probably recover quite quickly.
So Alicia, you're joining us down the line from Spain today. What's your prognosis for the short-term future of globalization, at least for the next 6 months?
Yeah, so I'm going to be gloomier, and not because of Spain, where it's sunny and fearless as coronavirus is concerned, because I live in Hong Kong, and that's where, you know, you kind of see more structural, if I may say, impact of coronavirus in not only the society, but the economy. And what really has been driving Hong Kong and places like Hong Kong, Singapore, and others, which is globalization. Two things I want to highlight. This crisis, the sanitary crisis, is heading towards an economic crisis, which I agree with what has been said so far, might be averted, but the way it probably will be averted is very much global financial crisis type, meaning stimulus. Stimulus will come strongly in China, and it's already happening, and I expect China to fulfill its a yearly growth target, which is very important for China because this is the end of a target set up by Xi Jinping for the nation's rejuvenation, which was doubling the income in 10 years. So it's going to happen. That's good news. So I agree with Nicholas, maybe for slightly different reasons. I think the economic crisis will be averted because of stimulus in China and probably elsewhere. However, it doesn't end there. The crisis goes from economics to confidence more generally and increasingly towards deglobalization. So what I mean to say is, I mean, in the different aspects of globalization, trade, investment, and people to people. So trade, we already know that global value chains reached their peak in 2008, and they've been coming down. But with the very important part that China became through that period and even before, but especially after 2008, the center of the global value chain. So of course, when you've become the center and the shock hits at the epicenter of that center of the value chain, you can imagine that those disruptions are going to be extremely important, not only shorter, but for companies to basically argue, you know, too many eggs in the same basket, let's diversify away. And I think that is indeed already happening. We see many companies taking drastic decisions in terms of their operations in China, some trade war related and increasingly coronavirus related. Finally, beyond trade, we are seeing something that I never thought I could see so quickly, which is people-to-people deglobalization. We may argue this is temporary because of the travel bans, the quarantines, etc. But you know, you could also argue that when you look at who is stopping whom, there is a little bit of geopolitics in the whole thing, yeah? So for example, India is not stopping China, but the US is stopping China. I mean, Chinese travelers into the US. Taiwan is stopping China and Hong Kong for that matter. I mean, India is stopping Italy and Iran. So why is this happening? Because I think we're at the peak of the globalization that many kind of disagree with, and the coronavirus is an opportunity in a way to rethink our people-to-people globalization of the last couple of decades, which has of course ballooned. So I leave it there, and that's all from my side for the moment.
Nicholas Verhoorn, is it time to move supply chains away from China?
The virus is no longer a Chinese issue. So I think Alicia rightly emphasized that the way businesses have to think about this is in terms of business continuity, diversification of suppliers, but there is nothing specific to China about the risk of pandemic. And indeed, the pandemic could have originated from somewhere else. Actually, there are voices in China who say it originated outside of China. That's probably not the case. But any country can, especially with dense populations and a number of environmental factors, can be the home country of a new pandemic. So it's not about ring-fencing China. It's about dealing with supply chains in a way that minimizes risk while handling it in a way that's still efficient. And that's a trade-off that businesses have to think about, and maybe that policymakers have to think about. Personally, I'm among those who think an open global economy is good for everybody. So I think it's more of a matter for businesses than for policymakers, but we can discuss some policy decisions at least at the margin. There is no case for closing all borders within Europe, certainly not. In the world, it has to be risk-based. Alicia is right to say that there is an interference with politics, but I think we're only at the beginning of a discovery process here as the virus continues to spread.
Alicia, would you like to respond to that? I mean, a pandemic can come from anywhere in the world. Why would we pick on China?
Yes, very quickly. The reason why things are different when the virus starts in China, and I still would argue, no matter what we've seen this week, that it is still a very much a China issue. And the reason is that, for two reasons. First, actually China today is the larger exporter by far of intermediate goods. We're talking about 35% of global market share, which is actually much bigger than China's role overall in trade, which is about 20. So, you know, it's in manufacturing. So China has become the center of the export of intermediate goods for other countries to re-export, i.e. the center of the global value chain. So of course every country can be hit, but the point is how important that becomes for the functioning of the value chain. And going back to the issue that this has become global, this is based on this on existing figures, whether you believe them or not, that's a different topic, but that Chinese cases outside of Hubei, as if Hubei were not important. Hubei is over 50 million people, which are still locked down. But outside of Hubei, as if Hubei didn't exist, yes, cases are decreasing in China while they're increasing elsewhere. But still, the overall number of cases is obviously still a Chinese issue. And I think we shouldn't shy away from saying that no matter how the markets are reacting. And again, I mean, Hubei is indeed a very, very important part even of the Chinese economy. So it's 10%, 9.5% of auto manufacturing for China. Think about that sector in terms of value chains. So I'm just saying, I think I understand the hype of, you know, the global transmission of the shock, which is indeed important. But I still think there is two reasons to focus on China. First, we don't know what's happening, frankly, fully. Especially in Hubei. And second, by the way, the limits on personal movement are well beyond Hubei. You know, they are happening across 600 million people. So they may not be as stringent, but they are still, you know, like basically in many, many provinces, you can only leave your home once every 2 days. So on that basis, I think this has global implications for the value chain because China is at the center of that value chain.
So I'll throw this out to Nicholas is here at Bruegel. Is it right that we should be concerned about having, well, firstly, a global manufacturing economy that's so based in one, well, that is so dependent on one country? And should we be worried that that one country is an autocracy where we can't rely on official statistics? It's not a specifically Chinese problem. It's the fact that we can't just trust Chinese statistics and that no matter which country we choose to do so much manufacturing, the point is we shouldn't have it all in one place where it's vulnerable to these kind of internal shocks.
So, if I may, I would first of all, before we talk about actually if it's good that we depend so much on China, I would push back a bit on this point that how bad is actually and how much is a Chinese issue. And I very much agree with what Nicolas said earlier. Basically, that this is a pandemic, it's a global problem. So we will might see the same kind of shutdowns we see in China now of factories closing down, also in Europe. And this is already happening, that a lot of companies are stopping doing like business travels, doing conferences. So it's not just that Chinese manufacturing is affected, we're globally affected.
You could say that because there's so much manufacturing concentrated in China, factories and cities closing down there is more significant than other places.
I mean, it's a big economy, certainly. I mean, if you think of 50 million, that is like roughly the size maybe of Italy. In terms of, I don't know, the GDP from one or Hubei province, it's probably smaller. It's maybe something like, I don't want to like call me out of my head with some figures, but it's like a significant part. But we speak of a country of 1 billion people, 1.3 billion people. And I think we should put this in perspective. I think also the other thing is that basically, the reason why we manufacture intermediate goods in China is not because we love China so much or companies prefer to be an autocracy. It's because of very economic reasons, and these economic reasons will stay. So what is the chance actually of... So first of all, we don't really know yet what will be how this virus will play out. The baseline scenario, I mean, there are very few estimates. The best one I saw was like in Economics Intelligence Unit says 75% chance this will die down in China by end March. So this is kind of the baseline scenario. And for companies to say, we are willing to repatriate our operations to like a very high wage place like maybe US, because of every 15 years, there might be a 2-year delay in our production. I find that a bit too strong for me. So I think we really have to wait how it comes, but I'm much more optimistic on that. I think the reasons, there are not many places too that can replace China just because of its size. I mean, there are not many, we have industries clustered within China that companies rely on, so I think it would be very difficult to replace.
Okay, but there were two things you didn't mention. Firstly, we're Democrats, and the reason that manufacturing in China is so cheap is precisely because it is not a democracy. And secondly, we can't really rely on Chinese statistics. Almost nobody will say that they know exactly what's going on in the Chinese economy. It's a massive known unknown about what the growth figures are like and how efficient it is. And so we don't know how stable it is, and we don't know what will happen tomorrow with the Chinese economy because we don't have that reliable information.
So first, it's not that China is cheap because it's an autocracy. I mean, there's many, many reasons. It's just a lower wage country.
You think if they could vote, they wouldn't vote for higher wages?
You don't vote on wages. Wages are like a result of an economic process. And because China is a less productive place, I think, Nicolas, you...
India is poorer than China. It's a democracy, at least technically.
So there's many economic reasons wages are low, and for companies this is already a case for many years that we don't really trust Chinese data. We don't know what the growth is. Then you have legal uncertainties, and you have to weigh that against the cost of producing somewhere else. And I think companies are already doing that for many years.
I think it's very important to go back to why is China so central to the global value chain, and as Nicolas very well put it. It's not because it's autocratic. Businesses may have, in some circumstances, preferences for, you know, repression of unions and things like that. But that's certainly not the first order factor. And businesses also like legal predictability and the rule of law. So there are some more nuanced assessments to make here. So the reason China is so big in the global value chain is a combination of two things. One is its sheer size, and the fact that it's been lifted by the reforms of the last 50 years out of 40 years, out of abject poverty, but also the fact that there were business decisions, right? Business decisions that were encouraged by the Chinese regime. The Chinese regime, for example, subsidized factories for companies that would locate in China, but who doesn't do that? And there were just very decentralized cost allocation, business planning decisions made by all kinds of businesses, not just US or European, but also Taiwanese, Japanese, from other places. Actually, the Taiwanese and Japanese are much bigger in terms of sheer size in China. So you have all this decentralized process. Now, the underlying question to your question is, what is our vision of globalization? Two questions here. One is, do we want globalization to be for countries that we label democratic? And that's a philosophical question. It's a high-level political question. I think fundamentally our values are respect for the human being. So I don't think we're ready to deny the promises of economic progress to human beings, even when they live under autocratic regimes, as a general principle.
Well, we do it with North Korea.
That's a very interesting question. And even there, I think if North Korea was willing to engage economically, there are many countries around the world, not necessarily the US, not necessarily European Union, that would engage with it economically. So then there is a bit of a question of who is we. But even in the very extreme case of North Korea, this principle is not absolute, the way you framed it. The second question is the definition of democracy, of course. And here, I think we have to look at ourselves. We have to look at a number of jurisdictions. And this, of course, is not to sugarcoat the breaches of human rights and minority rights and religious minorities and ethnic minorities in China. Everybody knows what's happening in Tibet, in Xinjiang. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. But I think we also have to acknowledge that I mentioned India before. We're in a time where the boundary between democracies and autocracies is shifting in a way that should not make us comfortable. And whereas these things are not set in stone. So this has to be considered very carefully. And this idea that, you know, there is a switch, you are either a democracy or you're not, and we should trade with democracies. Many people have promoted this idea over the last few decades. It's never gone anywhere because the world is a bit more complicated than that.
Alicia?
Yeah, but I want to go back to the issue of why I think the value chain is going to move away from China, and it has nothing to do with democracy. It has to do with economics, and the economics no longer make sense. But I have to add, and the reason why they don't make sense is very simple. Wages in China today are way higher on average than Malaysia, which is a middle-income country. Wages have been literally growing at the pace of 10% a year for years since 2008. As a tool for the Chinese economy to basically rebalance towards a consumption service-based economy. So China is no longer cheap, and companies know this. And by the way, by 2008 already, Samsung had already left partially China and now fully for Vietnam. So I think this is a process that is happening. The big winners are obviously in Southeast Asia. Since 2017, Southeast Asia has received more FDI than China. And that says it all. And as Nicolas was pointing out, indeed, the first ones to realize have been those who have invested the most in China. And those are Taiwanese, Japanese, Korean. The US and Europe is in the European and American investors are followers. And they, certainly so, because they know China less in a way than Taiwanese or other Asian investors. So the coronavirus is just one more trigger. The trade war was indeed one more trigger, but it had started even before the trade war. I have to, however, say that when we talk about China being such a large economy, when we say moving the value chain, we need to make a difference between the part of the value chain that was there to reassemble, to re-export, which will move, in my opinion. But the other part, which was there to serve the Chinese market, will stay. And this brings me to the democracy discussion. The part that covers the Chinese market will remain, the more so, the more China looks like a market economy. Forget about, you know, political issues, but we're talking about economic models. However, China in during the last 10 years, 2013 at least, and this coincidentally the time that President Xi comes to power, has actually moved away from a market economy, which means that many foreign companies operating in China for the Chinese market, which is still interesting, as I was trying to explain, however, face increasing hurdles to basically face the same operating conditions and the same market access, as we all know in Europe. And, you know, it's a usual mantra that we hear in Europe, the market access and the reciprocity. But the reality is that we're not the only ones. The American Chamber says the same. The Japanese, you know, like, is actually the case. So the coronavirus hits an economy, which, forget about the political regime, which is already fragile, which is actually moving inwards in terms of reforms, and that is increasingly expensive. So that's why it is important. So not everything will leave. I fully agree with that. But part of what China now accumulates in terms of value chain will move.
How fast do you think the Chinese economy will be growing 3 or 4 years from now?
You mean growth-wise? Mm. Yeah, okay, so maybe let's use somebody else's numbers so that there's no doubt that, you know, and by somebody else, I DRC. And the NDRC, so the National Commission for Planning and Reform in China, with the World Bank, issued a report in November, okay, before the coronavirus, with the growth rate averaging 1.7% for the decade 31 to 40. Unless with the assumption of limited reforms in China. So that's where we're heading, 1.7%, unless China, and this is the status quo, meaning unless China conducts very, very relevant economic reforms, that this report called Innovative China, very good reading for all of our, you know, all of the people listening to us now, clearly states which reforms are needed, and they boil down in the economic model away from state-driven production of goods and services. That's going to be very unlikely in the current juncture. At the current juncture, so 1.7 by 2031 on average up to 2050. It's a very low growth. It's actually less than the US, meaning China will stop converging with the US by 2031 on average. So that's a very different scenario than what we have in mind now.
And what do you expect China to move its economy towards?
You mean what's going to make China grow? Is that your question?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, of course, I mean, I'm not saying China will disappear. Let's even if China grows 1.7% by 2031, it will be the largest economy in the world. So something has to push that engine. And that engine will be pushed mainly by consumption. innovation. I'm not denying that all of this will happen, but the reality is that China will have missed, in my opinion, an opportunity to move up the ladder further, quicker, if the reforms of that economic model would take place. And it is indeed very unlikely. So yes, the growth model will still, and it's already happening, move towards more consumption and service-based growth model.
So yeah, I mean, not to be misunderstood, I think it's very, very, I agree with Alicia that the most likely future for China will be that it moves more to a consumption-driven, as it already had done over the last decade or so, to a more consumption-driven model of its economy. It will rely more on native innovation, on native consumption than it did before. I'm just not sure if which role coronavirus plays there. So if you look at the growth scenarios, so it really depends on how long this will play out, how long it will take, how big the contagion will be. But the estimates that I've seen by different entities are between 0.5 to 1.5 downward revision of Chinese GDP growth. 1.5 is the worst case scenario. So this is a lot. It would be like disastrous for any European countries. It would be a really big problem for China, but still they would grow at 4.5%. So I think there's yes, caution.
I think if we take a step back and we go back to the initial question you asked, which is basically about the future of globalization, it is not likely that and here I will echo what Nicolas just said, it's not likely that the pandemic will change the trajectory here very markedly. So in a way, what is more impactful is the trade war and what's happening to public policy in terms of a vision for globalization and the feelings that is increasingly entrenched in the US, that the US interest is to decouple from China. Now, the striking observation, if you look at this outside of a purely bilateral US-Chinese debate, is that most of the rest of the world is not willing to decouple from China or from the US for that matter. So this vision that globalization is doomed because there will be a crystallization of economic spheres of influence is something that at this point is promoted in the US. It's actually not promoted in China as such. In terms of trade policy, certainly, and it's not accepted by the rest of the world. So the future of globalization debate is actually much more open-ended than it may sound when looked at, especially from the US. And I spent last week in Japan. Japan has an attitude to China, I think I'm conveying it correctly, which consists of, and that has been the case for many years, for at least a decade, if not more, of clearly separating security issues from economic engagement. So the attitude is to pursue economic engagement with China, make business with the communists, but be very cautious and untrustful when it comes to political relationships and security. That's in contrast with the Trump administration vision that decoupling brings the security thinking, the political thinking, and the economic relationship together. I think this is a big debate going forward for a number of countries around the world.
I mean, doomed is one thing, but it's very likely that globalization, which was already taking a kicking at basically every electoral opportunity in the last 5 or 6 years, could just lose even more public support around the world. And without public support, politicians who are against globalization are going to have more and more ammunition to fire economists and technocrats. So I think I have two questions. Firstly,
First, let me question your initial diagnosis. If you look at the European Parliament, let's talk about ourselves, and you do a no-nonsense breakdown of the different groups in the European Parliament in terms of being mainstream pro-EU or non-mainstream anti-EU populist. We can discuss the labels, but let's do it no nonsense. The mainstream is the four groups, EPP, SND, Greens, and Renew, and the non-mainstream is all the rest, right? No nonsense. The current parliament has more mainstream MEPs in proportion of the total than the one 5 years ago. This might sound implausible to a lot of our listeners, but it's just the numbers. It's the hard numbers. So there is the narrative about the irresistible rise of populists, which is simply not related to reality. The political reality of our trends in Europe and also in other places is much more nuanced. So I think this factual clarification may be useful.
So do you think globalization is as popular now in the West as it was 12 years ago?
I look at the policies, for example, of the European Union and how they've been received in a number of member states. You look at the ratification of CETA, that was a big debate. It's not clear to me that we could have had an agreement like CETA ratified in all member states, including by subnational entities like famously Wallonia, 12 years ago. So there is nothing obvious about this.
So, and I would use this opportunity for a pledge for globalization, because I think it is like global. It becomes very clear with this coronavirus that the same as with climate change, global health is a global commons. If we don't work together in terms of science and healthcare technology, we will all be affected by it. We are affected now by the state of health regulations in a province in China that most people of us never heard of. The same, there's always this huge problem is in China, in India, not in China. Another emerging market is the state of the usage of antibiotics and kind of how clean the rivers are. There's also a huge risk that we might have antibiotic-resistant bacteria coming from another emerging market.
Isn't that all true because we've integrated our economies?
No, this is kind of, if you have a population that is somehow linked in this nowadays world, I mean, we don't want to stop flying to all kinds of countries. I think it's a great thing that we are so connected. But then we have to tackle together the problems that we have.
And more specifically, I think the globalization has different components, right? Exactly like in the single market, you have people, you have goods, you have capital, you have services, and you have ideas, of course. The epidemics is linked to the movement of people. This is not new. If you look at the Great Plague in the 14th century, it's a bit of the same thing. So it's not about economic integration per se. It's certainly not about financial globalization. It's about the fact that people can move for business, but also for personal reasons, between different parts of the world. Do we want to come to a world where we restrain that freedom of movement? That's a question which is slightly different from the question of trade wars, trade tariffs, and restrictions of capital flows.
Well, perhaps this is just purely anecdotal, my own perception, but it seems to me the lesson from elections in recent years is that it's simply not good enough to go into communities and tell them how much better their life is because they can buy a cheap washing machine assembled in China. It just doesn't seem to, even if it's true, it doesn't seem to win arguments. And now, when you look at the political landscape, we have a lot of resistance to globalization on the right, obviously, to preserve certain cultural aspects of societies, and a lot of resistance on the left to preserve some of the environmental aspects of our planet. You said it's great that everyone can fly everywhere. I think a lot of people would disagree with that now. And if people come to believe that both economic and medical contagion are just an occupational hazard of globalization, it's yet another reason for economies and people to at least emotionally turn inwards, even if the economic advantages of doing the opposite seem self-evident to people like us.
But I think we forget about, so yes, we have environmental problem that stem from flights and from us moving, but I think we forget about the positive impact this has. And this is like a very, we forget that like 70 years ago, Europe was a place of war. If you go 100 years ago, there was basically, we had constant wars, we had huge wars, First, Second World War.
No, I completely agree
and
with
so
what you're
saying.
So
I think if we want to, I know that you play the devil's advocate, so I'm now arguing against the devil.
Well, you're arguing against electorates who don't vote for parties that support this view of the world as much as they used to.
I think to fight xenophobia, you need people to meet each other.
The interpretation of political trends is not one-sided.
You disagree. Well, okay, we can save that political analysis.
I will interview you next time.
You're welcome to do so, yeah.
But I would argue that the rise of disruptive political movements, which certainly exist in a number of countries, first has to be kept into perspective because there is a bit of hype about that, and therefore looking at the numbers, as I tried to do, may be useful at times. But second is driven by a number of different issues. And if you look at Brexit, just to take an example, Brexit is about deep issues of identity. I think the Brexit vote is not straightforward to square with a rejection of globalization. Maybe a rejection of globalization plays a role in Brexit, but there is also all this narrative of global Britain and stop being shackled to the corpse of protectionist EU. So you have all these cross currents in the political trends and narratives that are happening right now. So I think we at Bruegel, we believe in facts-based analysis. We believe in empirical evidence. I think we should be cautious about relaying simplistic narratives.
Alicia, what are your thoughts listening to this?
I mean, I understand the European perspective that Nicholas are bringing to the table. And, you know, like the idea of deglobalizing a project that is based on literally, you know, free movement of everything is, of course, crazy. But my point was not so much to judge on whether deglobalization should happen. Of course, I agree that it shouldn't happen. I'm just arguing that it will happen and it is happening. That's all. So Europe can, and this brings me to, you know, what I usually describe as the Titanic. Europe can continue to stay, you know, the Titanic while it collapses and try very hard to keep its model, which has served Europe well, no doubt about it. But the world is changing. And we can't be the very last ones to realize this. So, indeed, going back to what I was saying, there is many forms of deglobalization which are happening. And I understand that this sounds horrible in the light of our political weaknesses, which I agree with Nicholas might not be as weak as we think compared to, you know, what's going on out there. But the thing is that we need to find a solution to how we're going to keep this open society, this freedom of movement of everything, yeah, and labor, capital, blah, 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 within the context of what's happening out there. So that's our real challenge. Denying it won't help because we'll be the very last ones to suddenly realize that nobody else is following this. And that's my point. And to the point that coronavirus is just, you know, like a blip and that we'll all go back to natural traveling, that every border will be open. I mean, from my Asian perspective, although I'm sitting in Madrid today, but that's where I've been sitting long enough to make this argument. From my Asian perspective, at least in Asia, that's not the way it's going to be.
Alicia, this is a really good discussion we're having, and I have a question to you. You spend a lot of your time traveling in Southeast Asia. You mentioned Vietnam and a number of other countries. If you look at Southeast Asia, or to take a different region of the world, if you look at Africa, is deglobalization happening there?
Yes, it is. I can't talk about Africa. I can talk about Southeast Asia. What I'm trying to say is the following. Try to find Indonesian working in Thailand. Try to find relevant, I'm not saying there's no investment, but relevant economic investment from Indonesia in Thailand is not happening.
Yeah, but is that the definition of globalization?
Sorry, let me finish, Nicholas. This didn't happen in Latin America either. Europe is very special. We have, for a number of reasons, historical reasons, decided, and I'm very happy about it, to trust each other. This is not the model, in my humble opinion, and I won't talk about Africa, but I can tell you, this is not the model of Southeast Asia. Countries agree on stuff they need, so some, you know, like standards for purposes of basically minimum collaboration, let's put it this way. But they've not engaged in a full trust operation to have freedom of capital, movement of capital and labor. They haven't and they will not do so.
Alicia, we can agree that ASEAN is not the EU and that there is a lot of distrust based on history and a number of other things between those countries. But isn't it the case that in, sheer measurements of trade openness and economic openness, openness is making progress, not regress in that region?
Well, I guess it depends on how you measure openness. If you tell me whether trade to GDP has increased, on average, yes, not everywhere, not in Indonesia, which is a major country, by the way. Whether tourism flows have increased, just not especially. I mean, yes, because of China, but it's not like cross-border massive flows of tourism, except for China going in Southeast Asian economies, especially Thailand. But what I'm talking about is really key integration. Is ASEAN becoming a single market? No. Will it become? No. And you ask me, will part of the globalization we've seen revert? Yes. I have full trust in Southeast Asia becoming a much more relevant player in the value chain, frankly speaking. But that doesn't reflect. I mean, that doesn't kind of, that's not the model we have in mind. And
isn't that globalization, so? Doesn't that count as globalization?
Well, there's many deglobalization factors happening. For example, you can't buy a financial institution in Indonesia for the last 5 to 6 years while you were able to do that before. And no country in Southeast Asia has opened up to foreign investors with control in most sectors. So, you know, it depends on how you measure it. If you only want to look at gross trade to GDP, okay. It's not increasing very rapidly either. But, you know, if that's how you measure globalization, what I'm just saying is that the world is becoming more localized in as far as countries don't trust even neighbors. I mean, we are in that, how do I say, historical economic phase. And this is partially also because of the confrontation between the US and China. You know, like countries have to take sides. They worry about which side to take. They worry about which side their neighbor, its neighbor is taking, you know? So I don't fully disagree, Nicholas. I'm saying it's more complex. At least forces pushing deglobalization. Think about investment. I mean, portfolio flows among ASEAN countries are non-existent. And it's been a while we created these swap lines. Yeah, I mean, it's been basically something that was created after the Southeast Asia, so the Asian crisis in 97. And nothing has happened since. So, you know, in other words, yeah, half full, half empty glass story. But the trend is not towards massive globalization. We are, in my humble opinion, at a turning point. And the coronavirus is just a tipping point because the level of mistrust that is creating among countries, look at Italy, look at what's happening with South Korea. I mean, it's just humongous and it's not going to disappear in a day.
Nicholas, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you for some final thoughts on this because we're kind of rapidly running out of time. But is it possible that we've spent the last 30 years since the Berlin Wall fell experimenting with the excesses of globalization? Now we're recoiling to a kind of more natural state. Maybe it's just going to be a case of 10% less globalization, not the end of globalization, not the beginning, just a leveling out.
Lots of things are possible. Lots of scenarios are plausible. I think what is more difficult is to know what direction we will be taking. In terms of the trigger for our, I think, very stimulating conversation, which is the coronavirus, I think we have to be humble because we don't know if this virus will mutate, how it will spread. We know that it's more than just a Chinese issue, but that's about as much as we know.
Yeah, I agree. I think at this moment we're all kind of a bit, and the uncertainties, I think that was what is scary and that would make it difficult to assess, but I very much agree.
Great. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Sound of Economics. I'd like to thank my guests, Nicholas Veron, Nicholas Bartier, and down the line, Alicia Garcia Herrera. Thank you very much for joining us. I've really enjoyed our discussion and I'll see you again next time. Thank you for listening to The Sound of Economics. This podcast was presented by me, Nicholas Barrett, and edited by Tiago Almeida, and brought to you by the Bruegel think tank in Brussels. To read our papers and blogs, you can visit bruegel.org, and if you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe on Spotify and iTunes, where you can also leave us a review
and let other people know that we exist. And you can stay up to date with everything we do by following us on Twitter @Bruegel_org. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.